Ida Richardson, Reel One. So if I could ask you, first of all, Colin, to tell me something about your family, you know, before the war started. Whereabouts were you born and brought up?
I was born in Aldborough in Suffolk. It's where the family home was. My grandfather was a country doctor in Saxmundham. And my father was the youngest of a large family. And most of the family were drawn into the medical profession, including my father, but he then made a transfer at an early stage as a student when he became a lawyer. He set up his work in London at the Inner Temple. The central part of London, and we lived in St John's Wood almost from the time I was born in 1929. I had one brother, younger than myself, called Julian, and my mother worked as a secretary in various firms until I was born, and I went to a school locally in St John's Wood. When the war came, my father decided that we should move out of London, and we went to live in Monmouthshire, in a small village called Llanelyn, near Abergavenny. My father, because of his work, stayed to live in London during the week, and was an area warden, but he was where he was old enough to be called up. He had a bad leg and he was unfit for military duty, so he became an air raid warden. And my mother either was staying in London with my father, or they both came down whenever they could into Monmouthshire. My father's work also took him on assizes to various courts in other parts of the Midlands, Birmingham, Newport. So I suppose that Monmouthshire was quite a convenient place to be evacuated to.
Was that quite a change for you, you know, coming from St John's Wood to Monmouthshire, the yes. sort of culture?
It was a big change, but being only 11, it was something that was different and so it's exciting. And of course we were away from the bombing in London.
Do you actually remember the outbreak of war?
Yes. My grandparents, my mother's parents, they lived in Lingfield in Surrey, and they had a reasonably large house, and at the outbreak of war we were digging an air raid shelter in the garden, and it was a lovely hot summer's day, and it was a very hard job because the ground was all clay, and then there was an air raid warning almost immediately the war was declared, which was a false alarm, but of course we had no idea what we should be doing because the air raid shelter wasn't completed. And we stayed there when we weren't in London, at the beginning of the war, because we really didn't know whether or not the war was going to be over by Christmas or not. Anyway, when we moved to Monmouthshire, I started to go to a local school there in the Abergavenny called St John's School, and I don't know if it's still there now. And my brother was old enough also to go to a junior school locally, and then when he got a bit older he also went to school in Abergavenny, and because there was so little traffic on the roads we used to ride our bicycles into Abergavenny, which is about 2-3 miles.
How did you get on with the locals, you know, the Welsh people?
Well, very well indeed. The farm we were on had no electricity, so it was oil lamps at night. But they went about their their duties of the farmer. We used to go out and help with crops, and we had really a big playground. The farm was quite large, it was quite hilly, and right on the River Usk, it was very beautiful. And we started to really enjoy living in Wales because of the wonderful views and the mountains, Sugarloaf, the Skillet, so on and so forth. It was absolutely perfect.
This, of course, would be during the Phoney War period,
yes.
Wouldn't it?
Yes.
Yes.
I mean, there were a lot of changes in Wales as well, as the young men were then being called up and the older people came out of the town to take up jobs. And we really sort of got on well in the farm. I used to wear, you know, the jumpers and rough clothes and ride horses and things like that. So we really had, it was a holiday in many ways, but still having to go to school.
Were you sort of following war events? You know, for instance, 1940, with the Blitzkrieg, would you have been aware of what was going on as an 11-year-old boy, were you?
Very much aware of it. And, of course, even in Abergavenny and places like that, there were signs of the war with fundraising and tanks on display, which we'd go and have a look at and things like that. And of course the newspapers came on a regular basis and we could follow the progress of the war and the whole problem with Dunkirk and everything else and the evacuation from the French coast. But of course all this, all the preparations for my own trip to America were slightly kept from me, because at that time I suppose my father was in correspondence with the people in America to see whether or not it was a practical solution to the problem that was likely to occur. That was the invasion of Britain.
When did you first become aware that you might be going to America?
I think my parents sat me down after supper and said, how would you feel about going to America? And of course, my idea, this was great, Hollywood, cowboys, all the kind of things that 11-year-old would think of. And my father said, well, it wouldn't really be there, it'd probably be in the New York area. But that still sounded very glamorous and different. And of course, food was beginning to get a bit short, and I could sort of see that it was going to be a more appetizing place to be than in England. But then I naturally turned around and started asking questions as to whether my mother and father would be coming and my brother. And they said no, that they felt that that wasn't part of the situation. And my mother started to buy clothes for me to send me to America, so I was properly equipped for what I might need in America.
Were you given any guidance? You know, I was wondering whether your mother was doing this independently or whether by the stage she was doing it through any organisation.
No, she was a very independent lady. My mother was brought up in South Africa. Her father was a railway civil engineer. So they could turn, my mother and her parents could turn their hand to almost any type of emergency without any need for help. She was always very practical in what she was doing, and if a problem arose, she knew immediately how to solve it and would go ahead and do it in a very forthright way. And obviously, as soon as she started thinking the problem through about sending me off alone to America, thing about child escort and things like that, and clothing, all came, and that was all taken care of.
She did that herself, did she, the escort business?
So in a way, yes, I suppose so. There are two methods of getting abroad, and my parents decided, because they had had contacts through American lawyer associations, to do it on a private basis. So that actually was one of the decisions that saved my life, because I was not with the government-sponsored evacuees, I was in another part of the ship. And in fact, a Hungarian journalist was found in Fleet Street, who was going to America, and he agreed to take me under his wing on the ship. Mr. Rasky.
Mr. Rasky?
Rasky, yes. I think it's R-A-S-K-I.
What was the name of your hosts in America?
Stickney was their surname. S-T-I-C-K-N-E-Y, yes.
So, preparation. Can you remember any details? Were there things you were insisting that you wanted to take with you to America?
Well, there were sort of restrictions. I think we allowed one trunk, which was put in a hold. And I think the only thing I took, there were two things that I took that I still miss. One was I had a motorboat, the Cockburn motorboat. And the other thing was a George III penny. Very big, heavy coin, but it was, if you like, my keepsake and treasure. I didn't really have anything else that I treasured or missed, but I still miss those two things.
And all this was done from Wales? All the arrangements?
No, I think it was done when my father was in London, because it was all a bit of a surprise to me. It wasn't something that was ongoing. I mean, the thing was virtually a fait accompli by the time they talked it through with me. And one really didn't have time to have a second thought about the matter as far as I was concerned. It was almost an inevitability. I think my father could see that the huge German army standing on the French coast, it was only a matter of days. So there was what you might call a sense of urgency about going and knowing the possibilities, the problems ahead if the Germans did invade. And even now I can hardly believe that they didn't actually do it, because the whole British army was in total disorganisation after Dunkirk. And whilst there'd be a will to resist, one has to be real that the Germans had an enormous army. Had there hardly any losses, and they've got through into France, and why shouldn't they go straight through into Britain? I mean, I know the Channel is an obstacle, but it seems to be extraordinary that they didn't complete the job.
Did you yourself, you know, as a young 11-year-old, have any sense of that danger?
Yeah.
And that you were going to safety?
Yeah.
You know, was that the...
Yes, I mean, we knew that the Royal Navy had a wonderful reputation of defending us, but it seemed that the numbers in the German army were so enormous that somehow or another it would be almost an inevitability. And I think the lay people could see that on a practical basis that it would happen. But of course, we're never privy to all the secrets and plans that are likely to occur if a German invasion had taken place. I mean, even now, it's still sort of things that we're discovering about a secret army being organised and things like that.
So, do you remember your, you know, the events of sort of leaving? First of all, you know, your home, your farm in Wales. How did you travel?
I trained up to Liverpool.
Oh, you went directly to Liverpool,
yes,
did you?
Mm-hmm. And my mother took me, and so, you know, we travelled with the luggage, and I mean, I must admit, I didn't, not very much of the actual journey up to Liverpool and arrival at the docks, I can remember. I think it was rather sort of awkward travelling on a train, but I'm sure my mother was giving me all the last minute instructions how to behave and all that kind of stuff. And had I got my £10 that my father had given me, because that was worth quite a lot of money in those days, at probably £100 now, it was something. I've never had as much money in my pocket in my life. And so I think the first thing really comes back into my memory is arrival at the shipyard, where things suddenly are really happening, and then suddenly the possibility of leaving my parents really became a reality rather than something just talked about. And we went through the usual sort of customs. I handed in my gas masks. We all had to carry gas masks at that time. And my identity card, that again had to be taken back into the country. And I had a passport that had been obtained for me. So I remember going through the big terminal buildings at Liverpool and then seeing the liner for the first time. There was always seems to be a bit of debate about its colour, but it was a liner designed for going between this country and India. It was on the India route. So it had, I suppose, a sort of tan-like colour on the hull. It seemed to be a slightly strange colour, but on reflection, I suppose it was the most suitable colour for a ship that was going out to the heat of the Indian Ocean and things like that. And it was full of Lascar sailors, this seagoing Indian crew. And it very much a little piece of India. They ran around barefoot. There were there others who were wore turbans. And it was really like walking into a small part of British India at the time. The ship was absolutely beautifully fitted out. It was not a big ship by present day standards. I mean, I think it was about 10,000 to 11,000 tons. And would hold about sort of 400 to 500 passengers, something like that. And of course, as far as I was concerned, I was going into a total area of luxury from a slight, a Spartan existence on a Welsh farm with oil lamps, no electricity, and what I call fairly rugged weather and living conditions. So, I mean, I said a fond farewell to my mother, and I think that she had the view that farewell shouldn't be drawn out, and as soon as she said goodbye, she probably turned around and walked away. And I thought the best thing to do was to do the same in the opposite direction, so that was it.
You were saying it hit you when you saw the shipyard. You know, I was wondering how you felt, because you were very alone, weren't you, as a private
yes.
person?
Yes. I mean, I wasn't being organised by anybody. Like a school teacher, because of the teachers with the other children. And I was introduced to my Hungarian escort, who was a nice enough person. He's quite relatively young, I suppose he was in his early 20s. But I didn't see very much of him. I think he felt that I was perfectly able to look after myself and could hardly get into much trouble for falling overboard. And basically we settled into our cabin, which was on the starboard side towards the stern. This cabin was quite luxurious in a way, two separate bunks, a little desk between the two bunks, and a couple of cupboards and a wash basin. And as far as I was concerned, it was quite super. We were told, you know, meals were at this time and that, and everything was very smart. We were able to wander around the ship. I wasn't under instruction from a teacher, and I wasn't getting any lessons. I had the library to myself, basically. And of course, I was quite an avid reader, as I still am. And that was, to my mind, a real heaven. When I was about watching the ship going about its functions, and really, I was quite happy to see the ship set sail and leave the very grubby dockside behind.
What day did you leave, and what time of day?
Well, we left on Friday the 13th of September 1940, which is not considered a very good day. It's considered unlucky. And I suppose we left in the afternoon, having arrived early, so about 11 o'clock in the morning, something like that, I can't quite remember. And the whole problem, as far as the ship was concerned, that it had to gather together the rest of the convoy to make up the convoy. So there was an awful lot of changes going on before the ship finally got into the sea. And I think probably we left, and then we anchored somewhere off the coast until all the other ships had been gathered together, and then we were the Commodore ship. The admiral in charge of the convoy was on our ship. And presumably then, once we all gathered together, they set sail for America.
What sort of sight was that, you know, being in a convoy?
Well, it was a very mixed bag of ships. I mean, I was surprised how small some of them were. But they had great difficulty in keeping station. In other words, in their proper row and line, and the speed was very slow indeed because of that. I mean, the liner obviously could go much faster, but was held back by the slowest ship in the convoy, whatever that was. Because it were so many, you couldn't really see all the ships, not from where I was anyway. And after sort of seeing these ships, it didn't really, you know, they weren't of any further interest to me because they were reasonably far away. They just happened to be just in the same place more or less all the time. So we settled down to a routine, and if it was a nice day, I'd go out on the ship's deck and have a look at whatever there was to see, watch the Lascars make their food on the aft deck. They were putting great sacks of rice and lentils and whatever else they ate, lifted up the shovels on the deck, like making cement.
Would you know, at that time, would that have been a fairly rare sight for a young English boy, you know, to have seen foreign people?
Well, I've seen a lot of foreigners in London, a lot of troops from all different countries. And I must admit, it was a very different experience to see sailors mixing their food on the deck in vast quantities. There was certainly no shortage of food. And it curries and other things that were offered at lunch, I didn't really like, but I, you know, I tried them. And so that was quite exciting. I was thinking, this rice I'm eating is probably, I've been on the course deck a bit earlier. But as everything was spotlessly clean, and I wasn't really too worried about that.
How about the other passengers? You know, were there other children there?
Well, the other children, I think, were more or less kept into their school conditions. They probably took over one or two of the reception rooms for classrooms and things like that.
These would have been the children evacuated by the government.
That's right.
Yes. I was wondering about other privately, you know,
well,
evacuated.
Well, there were other people around. And my mother had given me this life jacket to wear, this red K-pop life jacket. And I got the nickname Will Scarlet because I was always wearing it, and everybody thought, you know, it was a little bit unusual because it was like a, I suppose, an anorak these days. And it wasn't really necessary for me to wear it from the point of view of keeping warm. But my mother would tell me quite firmly that's the one thing I must keep on at all times, night and day. I certainly didn't wear it at night, but I had it right by my bed to put on. And some people really thought it a little bit strange and a bit odd. So that was, I think, why I was called Will Scarlet, because I was so noticeable by my red jacket. Of course, we had lifeboat drill. So we knew where we had to go, first of all to an assembly area, and then as soon as we were our numbers were correct, we then went to the lifeboat station where the lifeboat would be lowered to the deck on which we were assembled.
When you look back at that drill, you know, was it very thorough, you know, would you say?
I'm not certain that they actually lowered the lifeboats, which seemed, I think, of it in the reflection was a bit odd. But I must admit, they're fairly difficult to do. It's a question of hauling the boats up and down, and they probably weren't power-driven, just a series of pulleys. So I think the whole thing was that you have to imagine the lifeboat is here, and you will be getting over the ship's rail and into the lifeboat at this point, which always struck me as not being a proper drill, because I felt if I needed to get into the lifeboat and sort of say we've actually done it, because when events show that when a ship's in a heavy sea, these lifeboats can go swing out 20 feet from the ship and come crashing back in again, and it doesn't do the ship or the lifeboat any good. And of course, certainly not trying to get from ship to lifeboat on a swinging lifeboat is really very dangerous. And it doesn't seem to be a very practical way of taking the passengers onto a lifeboat. It needs to be redesigned. And I don't know what they've done nowadays on ships, but it's, the arrangements then weren't in my view satisfactory. For 11-year-old.
How about the weather? What's the weather like during this, you know, the early part of your journey?
The first part, 13th and 14th September, was probably fairly calm. I know that when the winds got up, we had a game with the deck chairs because the wind was blowing across the ship. But if you assembled a deck chair and put it on the upwind side of the ship and let the wind take the deck chair slide through the gangway to the other side of the ship, this was a great new game we discovered. I don't think they approved of it very much, but it was something to keep us occupied and going. But certainly the weather did get much worse, and then of course going outside and playing even those games became difficult. And I remember they started putting up the fiddles on the tables, which was to prevent the plates sliding off the tables. So that made eating quite difficult, quite interesting. And then you saw how the sailors and the waiters brought the food to the table, sort of leaning at the right angle. So yes, it was exciting, and in a funny way, I thought this was going to be safer for us because you couldn't really imagine that in rough weather, A, we would be found by enemy submarines, and even if they did fire torpedoes, because of the weather and the condition issues of visibility, etc., if I felt was made things much better. So in a way, we rather welcomed the rough weather, as I did, and welcomed the rough weather. I've always envisaged that if the sea was absolutely smooth, you were in real dangers because the enemy could be miles away.